Last lecture, we talked about the fields instead of particles, and we said how path integral formulation can be formulated for fields instead of particles. For that, we introduced Lagrangian density for field, and we, keeping in mind that the Lagrangian or the action is a Lorentz invariant, the Lagrangian density was found to be this quantity here, okay? And I think there was some confusion with Lagrangian density being scalar invariant or not. This is not scalar invariant, but the Lagrangian has to be scalar invariant. This was the interaction term. An interaction term is within the field points. It's not something applied from outside. So if we are defining a field, and each field point has some kind of interaction between them, so this phi term represents that interaction. In classical limit, we saw that we get our usual Euler-Lagrangian equation for our fields. And we saw that the equation of motion for the classical fields is the Klein-Gordon, usual Klein-Gordon equation, which makes sense. So what we are going to do is we are going to define our part of Lagrangian from here with the n-harmonic terms excluded in our interaction term, plug it into this Lagrangian density, and then we are going to call this the Lagrangian density for our Klein-Gordon, okay? And whatever we are going to do is now with this Lagrangian density, and it's called the scalar field phi, free field. So outline for today's talk, today's lecture would be, we are first going to try to find this amplitude for our scalar free fields, which gives us the probability amplitude that my field in vacuum state is evolved in vacuum state. Okay, so that's the probability density for this. And this vacuum to vacuum evolution is really interesting because it gives you the property of the vacuum. It gives you the vacuum energy and so on. But we won't talk about vacuum in today's lecture. I'm sure there are some lectures related to vacuum energies and so on, which Dan is going to cover. So we are not going to talk about those. Instead, we are going to introduce some kind of a disturbance in our field, which will perturb our vacuum, and we'll see some different kind of physics, all right? And when I'm saying vacuum, what I mean is maybe a ground state. It could be like ground state for a state, which in where all the field points have zero amplitude or something like that, okay? Just naively speaking. So, as I said, what we are going to do try today in the outline is we are going to try to calculate this, but also introduce something called a disturbance in our field, which would appear in this Lagrangian. And eventually, what this would lead us to is called propagators. So we'll have extensive discussion on propagators of these fields. And these are important because they define how the disturbance whatever the disturbance which you have introduced in your field, how they are going to propagate in space and time, okay? So they are really important in describing number of phenomena like how particles they appear or how forces they act within the field. After this detailed discussion, what I want to cover is the enharmonicity in our fields. Because there was one of the feedback where somebody suggested probably I should be talking about this, okay? So the Lagrangian which we are using here for this part of the lecture doesn't include any kind of enharmonicity in the potential. So all these higher order terms are ignored. We'll see how the enharmonicity, if it's introduced in the field, how we can tackle them using perturbative techniques. All right, so this is just the outline, and I hope I can cover them in another 1.5 hours. Okay, so any questions so far? All right, so our aim is to calculate this field amplitude. Which in last lecture we wrote as an infinite path integral and the Lagrangian which we are going to use is the scalar field Lagrangian. Okay, and as I said, this is a vacuum to vacuum probably amplitude, and since this is an eigenstate or eigenfield for the Hamiltonian, it would give us some information related to the vacuum, which we are not interested in right now. So what we are going to do is we are going to perturb this vacuum a little bit by introducing a disturbance, which would be introduced by adding this J term, which is called as the source in our Lagrangian density. Okay, so I'll replace my Lagrangian by, and this is a function of space-time, and this is also a function of space-time. So imagine like having a field which has same, all the field points have same value, and over a space-time you change the field value. So you kind of remove the symmetry of the field, okay? It's something like that. Maybe it could be a delta function or any other function, all right? So, and this would be my z. And since now it's a function of my source term, I can write it as and for just sake of convenience, I'm using JS. So I'll just move back and forth with this representation, okay? But this means that these are still function of my space-time. So x is my four vector, right? And maybe it's useful to write the metric and four vector which we are using. So I think the four vectors which we are using in the metric is 1, -1. Okay, so I'll just keep this on the part of the mode. All right. Let's look at this part of the integral over d4x. Which I can write as now, if I integrate this over, integrate it by parts, I'll get terms like this. And this term here should be 0 because my field at boundaries is 0. If I substitute back it in my amplitude, so what I want is I want to evaluate this integral here, and there are a number of ways of doing that. What we know from quantum field theory is that we know the value of Gaussian integrals, right? So if somehow I'm able to change this integral into a Gaussian integral looking form, it will be much easier for me to do this integration. So we'll use a mathematical trick here. And instead of one variable, space-time variable x, we'll introduce two space-time variables, okay? And replace this integral by, which mathematically would be equivalent, there won't be no differences, but it'll help us reduce this form into our Gaussian integral form, okay? And the later part of the integral remains as it is. So if you see, these two integrals mathematically are equivalent, and this would help us reduce it in the Gaussian integral, okay? I'll call this part, it's a function of x minus y as a, okay? And if you compare this integral with our generalized n variable integral, which was part of our tutorial, which looked something like this. Remember, this was our last question in the tutorial, last tutorial, and this integral is
squared act on the delta function.
Which del square? This?
Yes, if the derivative acts on the delta function or not.
Yes, it must, because this would give you the correct form. If it doesn't, then I think it won't give you the correct form. So it must act on the del square, acts on the delta function, yes. Let me do a few steps, and maybe it would be more obvious why this should act on this delta function, because we are trying to change it into a wave kind of looking equation, okay? In my notes, I have it here. If I take del square of this, would it be defined? And mathematically, would it matter if it was here? Let me check this. Let me come back, okay? That's a good question. I'm not sure if this should act on it. And if I just don't act del square on del square, will I still get the wave equation or not? Okay, so let's keep this as a question mark here. If this is here or this is here, okay? Yeah.
I think what has been done to get this is like substitute like phi of x with the integral of the delta, of the direct delta on phi of y. And then the only dependency in x is in the delta, so y can be pulled out of the differential operator and the integral too, because the differential, yeah. So this is, in which coordinate does the del act? Does the del act on x or y?
This x.
Because it was there.
Yes, it was there. Yeah. So this x on x. but I'm not sure if it should be here or here. Let me do a few more steps and then see, okay? Because in my notes, I wrote it here, but I have a feeling if I have it here, I might not get the correct wave equation I'm dealing with. In fact, not. Maybe let's keep it the order, because it's going to complicate things a lot. Let's change the order for now, and if we think it should act, we'll. Okay. All right.
But this should be zero because phi depends on
why?
The derivative is.
I think previously we can define the del with respect to y.
But del has already been defined.
This is del with respect to x, but there's a delta function as well here.
Yeah,
no,
but like
if you act on phi y, which is not dependent on x, I mean,
so you would just have minus m squared y.
Let's just keep this as a question. And how about okay, it won't make much difference. I'll just change this to x minus y. Okay, for now let's keep this and then see if this ordering would change things or not. All right, okay. Because I agree if del square acts on delta function, it's going to cause some extra effects, which I'm not right now sure if are required in the end or not. All right. Okay, thank you. So if I compare my integration for these n variables with the integration up here, I can just make a replacement over continuum and then write this integration as, and let's call this as z0, because this would be the integral value if this j was 0, okay? So I'm going to call it as z0 instead of writing this vector again and again. Where this D here is inverse of A, and A have been defined this quantity. Okay, so I can write where D is defined as A of inverse. Okay, where A is defined as Now, this D here has a very special name, and we'll see why. But these Ds are called propagators. And they have exactly the same function which propagators in quantum mechanics they have. So how many of you know have seen something like this in quantum mechanical courses? All right, so they're exactly the same. What they do is these propagators kind of propagate your wave function in space and time at a later, at a different space and time position. So they do exactly the same thing here. They kind of propagate your disturbance from one space point to a different space point, okay? Okay, now our goal for the half, at least half part of the lecture is talking about these propagators. And I'll come this when we have the equation, we'll check if this is correct or not, okay?
I'm a bit confused about how we are going back and forth between just numbers and matrices for A in particular.
In here?
Yeah. Because I thought A is just kind of a function, but then we are also defining a matrix, so.
A is a matrix, and you can write operators. It's kind of operator, which you can write as a matrix.
So A matrix is just the equivalent form that corresponds to the function F.
For the operator A, yeah, it depends on what kind of function you are taking.
Okay.
Yeah, we can define a matrix corresponding to an operator, and A here is an operator something looking like this. So this is an operator.
Okay.
Okay. So let's try to find what this D propagator should look like. And from here, I can say that A and D, they are inverse of each other. So again, which in continuous limit, so instead of writing them in terms of the discrete limits in matrix form, I can write it in a continuous limit as and I know what is A from here. So if I just substitute A from in there, I would say del of y minus x. And this delta function helps me get rid of this integral. And I can write my equation for del square plus m square dx dy minus x del for y minus x. Okay. And I think this is the correct form. So my del should be del square should not act on this delta function. Otherwise, I would have not been able to write this form in here using this integral. Okay, so this is the correct thing. Okay. Yeah.
So we changed the sign in the front of the del. We did some integration by parts or something like that.
Change sign in front of the del. This del.
Up is minus del square, and it's like del square.
Minus is still there, and minus is still there. Okay. Okay. So this is the equation, differential equation, which my propagator satisfies. So in notes, if you're looking, my x and y's have been replaced, so I'll make those changes in my notes, okay? Don't get confused. What's x is y here, and what's y is x here. In my notes, I'm talking about a propagator which propagates a disturbance produced at y to x. Okay, in here I'm doing the reverse because of this good point which has been mentioned. All right, so this is a equation, differential equation, which can be solved using, I think, Fourier techniques, maybe some different techniques if you know. I'll just directly give you the solution for that. And that solution would be discussed in detail, like what kind of physics that solution gives us. Does that make sense? Okay. So instead of solving this differential equation, I'll give you the solution for the propagators. And it's easy to check if this is a solution of that differential equation or not, okay? All right, so let's see if this equation here is a valid integration or not, or if we need to change it. Like, how can we solve this integral and find the value of our propagator, okay? So I'll first integrate over k naught. So k is my momentum four vector. And we are choosing our x as and t prime is the time corresponding to my y. I think this would be a covariant, so there should be no negative sign. Yeah, this makes sense. All right, okay. Let's see how we can evaluate this integral in here. So this is an integral over the real axis from minus infinity to infinity. One way would be to change this integral into a complex plane for k naught. And then use the residual theorem to solve it, okay? So what we are going to do is we are going to concentrate on this part of the integral. And instead of integrating them on the real axis, we are going to integrate them on a complex plane for k naught, okay? So this is real k naught, and this is imaginary. All right. And the integration runs from minus infinity to infinity. What I need to calculate this over the complex plane is the poles for my function, right? And the two poles for this function are at, so I can write this as k naught square minus k square minus m square. Call this as omega k square, okay? So the two poles for my function in here would be at k naught at omega k and k naught at minus omega k. Okay. And the poles, they lie on my integration limits. So we have to find a trick of solving that because on these poles, my integration is not well defined. So I won't be able to do it. And usually, the trick we use for such integrals is to choose a detour over the poles, right? So usually what we do is instead of choosing my contour from minus infinity to infinity, we make a little detouring over the poles. So let's check if this trick would work or not. So let's check it for one of the poles at omega k, okay? So what I am going to do is I'm going to say that integrating over this contour from minus infinity to infinity would be equivalent to integrating over this excess and this small semicircle here. Okay, so I can write my integration I as this integration over the real and this integration over small semicircle, and both would be equivalent if my contribution from this small semicircle is 0. Okay, both would be equivalent and would be equal to this desired integration which I want. So is equivalent if I bring this semicircle to my contour, the original contour, which was this real axis. So if I bring it close to this. Or I could choose my detouring on the upper half plane instead of the lower half plane, and then say that this integration I would be sum of IR and this I semicircle, and let me say like semicircle with a prime. So both these should be equivalent. So I from here and I from in there would be equal to now, before I do that, I need to check if actually this contour here would give me zero results if I bring my contour to the like the semicircle to my real axis. Okay, if this doesn't give me zero, then I cannot write my I as sum of these two. So what we are going to do is, if both these approaches they are equal, which they seem to, they are giving me same integration, then the difference between these two, let me write as I1 and I2, should be 0, which means should be 0, right? And this is my integration over the semicircle in the lower half plane, and this is my integration with pole on my upper half plane, and I can just change my order of the integration and bring a plus sign here, and this should be equal to this complete closed contour. Yeah.
I'm not understanding.
Okay, what we are trying to do is we are trying to solve this integral, and it has two poles. So we need a trick to avoid these poles, because on these poles, my integral is not defined. And usually what trick we use it, we take a detouring over the pole, and then whatever detouring, like in this case, a semicircle we have taken, we bring this semicircle on our actual actual contour, which is minus infinity to infinity. And if this contribution is 0, we can say that integrating like this would be equivalent to integrating on my real axis from minus infinity to infinity. So what I'm trying to check is if this contribution over the semicircle is actually 0 or not. If it's 0, then I can take this detouring, calculate my integral, and this integral would be equal to this integral here. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I have another question, but maybe I don't remember it correctly. You have a closed loop around a pole. So the answer is non-zero, right?
Yes, exactly. The answer is non-zero. Okay. So there's a pole. The answer should be 2 pi I residue over the pole. So this is non-zero, which means that this contribution, even if my radius for this semicircle is 0, would not give me a 0 result. So this is not the right approach to do it. We can use other tricks, like maybe making this as a complete contour and then integrating. So there is a number of ways of doing this. What we are going to do is we are going to change our integral form a little bit by introducing a small deviation, and then in the end say that that small deviation is 0. So what we are going to do is we are going to change our form of integral from there steep right st and then introduce a variable epsilon which is positive and real, and then in the end whatever we get from here, in the end we would say that epsilon would tend to 0, and that integration would exactly match what I need. Okay, and by doing this, if you see, we have cleverly avoided the poles on our real axis. So the poles for this function here would be at so the two poles for this function would be at so these are the two poles for this, and by doing this we have avoided the poles on the real axis, which was my contour. Okay, and it, you can easily check, you can just multiply both, you'll get this using the fact that my epsilon is really small, and if I multiply epsilon by any positive number I'll still get epsilon. Okay, all right. So if I check how these poles they look on my K0 plane, and this is my contour from minus infinity to infinity, we'll see that one pole is at omega k, and so this is omega k minus I epsilon, and the other one is somewhere here, omega k yeah, this is positive, yeah, this was right, omega k minus I epsilon, and this is minus omega k plus I epsilon. Now my poles, they don't lie on the real axis, and I can use usual contour integral tricks to calculate this. And what we are going to do is we are going to use the trick that this real integral can be calculated by closing my contour and then calculating the residual of the poles which are inside the contour, which would really ease out my integration. And if you look in here, there are two ways to close the contour. One would be closing it in the low half plane, and the other would be closing it in the upper half plane. Which to choose would depend on our factor here. Okay, so I'm going to write something called Jordan's lemma, which is going to help us choose which way the contour should be closed, in the lower, in the upper half plane. Okay, so yeah, So Jordan lemma says that if I'm integrating over a semicircle in a complex plane for z, then if I choose, if my alpha is greater than 0, it's a positive quantity here, then I should close the contour in the lower half plane. Because if I close it in the lower half plane, my contribution from this lower half plane would be 0 for minus infinity to infinity limits. So if the contribution from this contour, this semicircle, is 0, what I'll get in the end is integration only over my real axis, which I want. Okay, I'll just repeat this once more. What we are trying to do is we are trying to find this integration over the real axis, which runs from minus infinity to infinity. And what we are going to use is, instead of calculating it over the real axis, we'll try to find the integral on a complex plane by closing my contour. It's a closed contour, which eases out my calculation, because if I close the contour, my integration would be just calculating my residues at the poles which lie within this contour, right? Within this closed contour. But I could only do that if this semicircle which I added extra to my integration, it doesn't give any contribution. And Jordan lemma says that you can look for the proof. It's pretty complicated. But what it says is that if I have an integration of this kind, which looks similar to what we are doing, and alpha is a positive quantity, then if I close the contour in the lower half plane, then my contribution from this semicircle for an infinite radius semicircle, because this is minus infinity to infinity, would be 0. That means I would just be including the contribution of my integration over the real axis. All right, okay. So if alpha is 0, which means that I could choose my contour in the lower half plane if t prime minus t is greater than 0, okay? So alpha, the role played by alpha is t prime minus t, and I'm taking integration over k naught, which is z here. So if t prime is minus t is greater than 0, which means then I can evaluate this integral and I can write my residues. And this would be just 2 pi I residues of the poles within this residue at omega k minus I epsilon. And since my contour is in clockwise direction, I'll take a negative sign here. Okay. And this should give me so residue at this point, you can easily check, would be equal to yeah, this is right, okay. And I've used the fact that epsilon tends to 0 while calculating the residue. Now for alpha less than 0, which would mean I'm talking about t prime minus t less than 0, if I take the contour in my upper half plane, then the contribution from this semicircle, it goes according to Jordan lemmas, for this, I should take upper half plane as my contour. Okay, now if I do that for this case, again my integration here would be equal to 2 pi iota residue, and if you see in my upper half plane, the pole is at minus omega k plus iota epsilon, so residue at minus omega k plus I epsilon. I calculate this residue from here, I'll see that it would be equal to minus 1 over 2 omega k for epsilon going to 0. So if I substitute it in here, my integration would be changed to am I missing an iota sign here? Check. I think there's some factor missing here. I'll check and replace it here, okay? So, fine. This integral, this particular integral which we are interested in for this time limit would be equal to and since my contour here is in counterclockwise direction, it will be 2 pi I, not a minus sign. My complete integration here, which was from minus infinity to infinity, has now been broken into two separate regions. One for the negative, like one for t prime minus t less than 0, and for t prime minus t greater than 0. So I can write this integration as sum of both, all right, depending on if I'm looking at my disturbance according to this relation in time or according to this relation in time. I'll explain what I mean by this. Is the math clear? We'll come to the physics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that the factor of 2 pi that you have in both cases becomes absorbed by the 2 pi in the denominator.
Okay.
I remember that it's not trivial to take the limit where you have something in the denominator minus a small imaginary part and that going to 0, but as you said, you can check it and tell us what's the correct factor in front of it.
Which factor? I'm sorry.
The extra minus I or plus I. I don't remember if they are supposed to be there, but you can check this.
Oh, okay. These I's?
Yeah, these.
In here? Okay. I can check this, yeah. Good, my nose says I in here. And I think there should be an I because if you have this I, it exactly matches with the canonical transformation propagators, which we'll just see that if we have an I, I'm pretty sure there should be an I, but still I can check. If you think there shouldn't be any, without these I, they won't match exactly with our canonical transformation propagators. Okay. But yeah, I'll check. So I can write my integration, the entire one now, which is my propagator, as and this part, the integration over dk naught, I can write as So this is the part from my t prime minus t greater than 0, which gave me minus I epsilon minus I omega k t prime minus t by 2 omega k. So I'll bring 2 omega k here, since it's common for both the vectors, and also minus I outside. So this is for t prime minus t greater than 0. And if my t prime minus t is less than 0, then my propagator, like the integration over dk naught, is exactly the same thing except for a positive sign in my exponential. And I can write these conditions that this part is non-zero only for this condition, and this part is non-zero only for this condition, in terms of something called the step function. Or a Heaviside step function, which we write as theta t prime minus t and theta t minus t prime. So this theta here is the Heaviside step function. Defined as follows. So it's a kind of a smooth step-like function. So instead of a discontinuity at x is equal to 0, it's a kind of smooth function. And this width here is the delta width. And the fact that we need a smooth kind of function is that because if you look at, I think if you look at the equation for del up there, we need del square to be operated on my d. So if it wasn't a smooth function, we would have run into problem there. For a discontinuous function, I won't be able to take del square.
Do you mean 1 for x bigger than?
And there's an exponential factor also missing. Yeah.
Sorry, do you mean 1 for x bigger than delta over 2?
For 1? For otherwise. Yeah, this is 1. Oh, there's a typing, like there's a mistake in my notes as well. Yeah, 1 for this range. Okay, this is all about the math. I want to at least give at least 5 minutes for what we are doing in terms of physics.
Should you divide the result by 2 omega k?
Yeah, 2 omega k.
Oh.
Oh, it's not, sorry. Yeah. Okay. And I'll check with this minus I form, but I think if you check with the propagators in canonical transformation, which I think Dan might also cover, there is a minus iota in here. And the reason why I'm emphasizing on this fact is that whatever we have done using path integral formulation in our field theory is equivalent to what you are going to do in next 7 lectures using canonical transformations, okay? What this propagator gives us, so we haven't still yet completed the integration, but that's not of the interest which I want to talk now. What I want to see is the nature of this propagator in terms of the time at which we are looking at the disturbance. Okay, so let's have 5 minute discussion on that, and then we can talk about the enharmonicity. Any questions related to the math part in here? Yeah.
So how do you take the derivative of that function?
Derivative of which function?
Because you said you need to act on it with del.
Oh, the derivative of this function would, I think, would give you directly delta function, but you don't have to worry about that right now. It's the reason I could have chosen a step function here as well, right? The step function would have kind of given me the same things which I required, that I needed to club two parts, one for t prime minus t less than 0 and t prime, I think. But that won't be physically correct, because this d satisfies an equation like that. And I would run into problem if I choose a step function, like a steep step function in here. So I'm using a heavy side step function. OK. So this kind of propagator is called a Feynman propagator. There are two more kinds, maybe more, but I know of these two, which are the retarded and the advanced propagators. And Feynman is actually has contribution from both the retarded and the advanced. And what do these retarded and advanced mean? If you look at this contribution in here, it says that this form of my propagator is giving me information for any events which are happening in like future. So t prime is greater than t. And this is something which is, so this kind of propagator is propagating something which is which has happened in past. And I think these propagators are called retarded. So this is called retarded. And the one here is called the advanced. And if I draw a light cone, I'm just taking the x-axis, and this is my time. So what I want to see is if I created a disturbance at my x space time, so dxy is my disturbance, dy minus x is my propagator, which is propagating my disturbance jx, produced at x space time to a later space time or a different space time y. Okay, so this is my present here, where I created a disturbance. Then this kind of propagator retarded, it says, so if this is y on my space time, it puts, say how my disturbance propagated from t to t prime, okay? Because t prime is greater than t. And this part of this kind of propagator so if this is y, it kind of gives me an information from where my disturbance came from. So it gives me the information for my present propagator in here from a previous time, because this is where t prime is less than t. And somehow, this part of the propagator is related to the particles. And this part gives us negative energies. They give positive energies for backward propagation, but we perceive it as a forward propagation with negative energies, and they are related to the ND particles. Okay. Anything anyone wants to add or have a question before we switch to the next topic, which is entirely not related to the propagators? But if in the end, if I have time, I'll show you how these propagators, with a correct choice of my disturbance, could lead to creation of particles and forces. But that won't be part of your interviews or lectures. But I, since I had prepared it, I probably might show you the slides which I have, the propagation, how the disturbance they propagate in fields. So I have a few animations to show.
When we wrote the solution to the second one using T prime and T, what was the I was wondering where the T prime and T came from.
So my exponential. Has this dot product for my momentum and the space vector. So this is and with I'm choosing h bar and c as constants. Or maybe I can just directly write like this.
Oh, I see. So t prime corresponds to the y zero and
T prime corresponds to the future, yeah, the time where I'm looking at the propagation has, like the disturbance has moved to. Yeah, okay. All right, so can we move to the next topic? How to calculate enharmonicities in fields using path integral formulation. And I think you're going to do exactly same thing with the canonical transformations in the coming lectures, okay? Okay, so till now in our fields, we just chose a interaction term which was proportional to phi square, which was the harmonic term. And this is, as we also mentioned, is called the scalar field, free field. And you can add higher order enharmonicities in your interaction, which kind of means that we haven't made particles yet, but in terms of if my field was able to produce some particles in some other field, what it would mean that such scalar free field would mean that the particles, they are not interacting with each other when they are produced. They just pass away and they don't interact. But if you add some kind of enharmonicity, there's additional effects of particles interacting or colliding or stuff like that, okay? So, the probability amplitude which we calculated so far, not entirely, but yeah, we tried to see a part of it. Was this with the added source term. Let's see what would happen if I added higher order enharmonicity in my F phi term. So F phi was till now only giving phi squared contribution. There was no higher order terms. And just for the sake of simplicity, we are going to choose this kind of enharmonicity, okay? You could choose cubic or others as well. They are, I think, more complicated. I just want to demonstrate the mathematical trick to how to handle this enharmonicity, okay? And we won't directly start with the fields. we'll break this problem into a couple of simpler steps. So first we'll try to find, and since now I have a dependence on lambda also, I'll replace my zj with zj lambda. Okay, so this lambda gives me the order of perturbation, I could say. So if lambda is square, it's a second order perturbation and so on. So this kind of additional perturbation in my interaction for the field. Okay, so I'll just demonstrate the mathematical steps, how to tackle with such inharmonicities. Without the inharmonicity, it was just we tried to break it into Gaussian integral, right? That's what we did, because we know the answer how to solve Gaussian integrals. And in here, we probably might also try to do the same, somehow reduce this into a Gaussian integral form. And we'll start with a simpler integration, which doesn't involve fields. And we'll see how we can solve this integration. Okay, it has this inharmonicity term added to it. And there are two ways to do it. One is, I think, if I've written Schwinger's way of doing it, and the other is Wick's way. In this way, what you do is you try to break your integral in powers of lambda. And in the other way, you try to break your integral in powers of j. Okay, but both the approaches are equivalent. Let's do the Schwinger's way first, and then see how this integral can be written in the second approach by Wick. Okay, and then from here, we'll try to build this integral. So again, there are a number of ways to calculate this. The one which we are seeing here is the one which is used extensively in field theories. Okay. And I'm going to expand this exponential in terms of lambda. Okay. Now convince yourself that I can take these powers of lambda outside the integral if I write my amplitude as follows. Because each of these terms, when acted on this integral here, would give me exactly these coefficients inside the integral. So this one would give me the first term in here. The second term here is the derivative 4 times for this quantity, which would give me Q4 term, and so on. Okay. And this I can write as an exponential of lambda 4 factorial d by dj 4 and an integral which is very familiar looking integration. This is my Gaussian integral. And 2 pi by m square, which I can write as z0, 0. So the constant factor is in here for the Gaussian. Okay. The other way is the Wick's way. Let's see how that works. So it's more popular among particle physicists. What they do is, instead of expanding in powers of lambda, they expand in powers of j, okay? My lambda term is in the exponential, and what I'll do is I'll expand the exponential, which was in J. And this can be written as sum over S, 1 over S factorial from my exponential JS, because it doesn't depend on my integration variable. Both the approaches are same, and I wanted to demonstrate like how mathematically they are same by evaluating the coefficients for one of the terms, let's say lambda j4. So this is what I wanted to do, but I'll just tell you how you can do this, and maybe this could be part of your homework, okay? So in here, if you see, what I want to see is if the coefficients from both the approaches, like the terms from both the approaches, are they are same or not, okay? So we are going to try to find the term corresponding to this lambda j4. What's the coefficient corresponding to this term? And again, what's the coefficient corresponding to this term in here? And then see if both the coefficients are same or not. If they are, then probably for all the coefficients or all the terms, they should be same. So in here, if you see, if you want to find out the coefficient for lambda j4 term, which means you're only interested in maybe from here. Yeah, so you're only interested in this here, right? Because this is the only term which has lambda as one power. And this has attached to it a four-time derivatives with respect to j. And what you want in here is a j power 4. So which means that for your exponential here, you'll get terms in powers of q's, right? If you expand. And since this term is going to take away four of the powers, what you need from here expansion is this. So whatever is the coefficient for, in this term, the coefficient for the q8 power multiplied by this vector would be the coefficient for lambda j4. This would be much easier to check. For the Wicks approach, however, you need something extra, which won't be obvious for those who are seeing it for the first time. In here also you need a power lambda. So in this exponential, you need just the second term. And it has q4. And you need j power 4, which means s should be fixed as 4. So if you fix s as 4, you'll get q4 and q4, q8. And you'll need to solve this integral with a q8 power something of this sort, an integration of this kind would appear. And whatever you'll get from this integration multiplied with the other factors like lambda by 4 factorial would give a coefficient which would exactly match the coefficient from there. If you're not clear exactly what you are have to do, once you start doing it, it will be much clearer. What I want to say tell you here is that this integration is not so straightforward. What probably you will have to do in order to calculate such kind of integral is use your Gaussian integral. So use this Gaussian integral. And take derivative with respect to a multiplied by minus 2. I think you'll have to do it at least 3 or 4 times to find this value of integral. But if you do, you'll exactly get the value for this integral. Okay? So this might be, I'll leave this as a homework exercise.
Sorry,
yeah.
What exactly is our homework?
Homework would be to check if the coefficient for lambda j4 from Wick's way and the coefficient for the lambda j4 term using Wick, this approach, like both the approaches, the coefficients they match. And when you try to match the coefficients using this Wick's approach, you'll definitely encounter an integral of this form, which you can solve by differentiating your Gaussian integral here, I think 3 or maybe 4 times with respect to A. Okay, yeah.
Something that isn't clear to me is that in Wick's approach, in order to get from the second to last to the last line, did
yeah.
you expand on lambda? Because I don't see where did the lambda over phi factorial.
Oh, you'll have to expand over lambda as well.
We also have to expand over lambda.
Okay. So it'll be like steps of.
I think it might be more realistic if we did it in tutorial, or?
Do you want to add it in tutorial? Yeah, we can do that.
Maybe that's better.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that could be done. Tutorial tomorrow has a very interesting question, and I think that's my favorite tutorial, which is on Mark Zender's. So there's something which only few of you might have seen. And what we are going to see again is the interference pattern on the Mark Zender's, OK? But we can add this to the tutorial, yeah. I'm happy to do that. But then you'll have to dedicatedly work because I really want you to work on the Mark Zender's for sure, okay? And what I also plan to do is, with all the tutorials which we have done, I'm not sure if everybody, whatever I was trying to convey, you already got that or not, because those were thoughtfully put problems. In my lecture notes, probably I'll put a short note of what I wanted to convey through those tutorial problems, okay? And also, I would summarize the lectures. For each lecture, I'll just put the key points, which might help you for the interviews, okay? So today is my last lecture. I'll have plenty of time working on the notes and making them much better for you to be used for the interviews. So let's come back to the original integration. And this is usually in literature, it's referred to as the baby problem. We are going to move one step ahead. And now, instead of taking integration only over a single variable q, we are going to solve the n integrals. And then generalize that those n integrals to fields, okay? So our next step would be to see how this integration should look like. So instead of single integral here, we have now n integrals. And this is a, so So if I just remove this part of the inharmonicity, this is a Gaussian integral which we already know the answer for. So again, what we are going to do, we are going to use the Schwinger's way, the Wick's way you are going to use in your canonical approach. Okay, so let's look at that approach for today's lecture. I'll again expand it in terms of lambda and use the same trick that my lambdas, this expansion within the integral, could be brought out of the integral if I write these q's as differentials with respect to j. Okay, so we're going to do exactly the same thing. So this is my Gaussian integral, which I know how to solve. And this part of the exponential I can write as a series. And so on. This is equivalent to and you can convince yourself, the first term here, if I take it inside the integration, would give me first term here. This term means differentiating this 4 times, which would give me qi4. And then lambda by 4 is a constant factor. And then this term in here would give me sum over qi4. To the power 4 and so on. And I can write this as an exponential. Now maybe I should use that part of the board, because when I'm solving this, I'll just use discrete to continuum analogy and won't do the steps in detail on board. So this integral would be, it's usually called as the teenage problem, okay, in literature, if you find teenage problem. Now let's look at our last integral, which is the original integral over fields, which we wanted to see. And if you look at this problem here, my n integrals over q's have now been replaced by the integrals over phi. And instead of these discrete sum over the matrix elements, I have now integral over the space-time continuum. Because this part of the Lagrangian, if you remember, we had written in terms of, maybe I can write the steps. Yeah. And I can expand this again in terms of lambdas. and so on. Now, again, using the same trick that these can be brought outside if I write them as a derivative of my j. Now, in here, my j is a function. So I'm taking a derivative of a function, which would be kind of functional. And it's a there's a fancy way of writing it. And so on, and acted upon this Gaussian integral for which we know the solution for. Okay. And again, if you see the first term is, if you operate this inside the integral, the first term is exactly 1. The second term, if you see, if you operate on this, this is not j dependent. If you take four times derivative with respect to j, you'll get you'll get an integration over the space time x for phi 4, because this derivative is going to be a delta function. If this is a function of x, if this is a function of x, you'll see that when you take derivative, you'll get two terms like this. And this should be 0. And what it would give you would be the delta x minus omega. And in here, you'll have the exactly same form, which you had with the expansion of lambda inside the integral. Okay, so you'll have to probably convince yourself by doing just a few steps in here, which are not too difficult to do. Okay, I think this is it. I wanted to show more related to particles and forces, but I didn't want to rush because this is an approach which I think at least some of you might have seen for the first time. And I just want to summarize what we did during our lectures. So lecture was a club of various quantum theoretical approaches we could use, starting from the ones which almost everyone had seen in the lectures, like the Schrodinger, Heisenberg. But we tried to bring in concepts like the time evolution and revival times using those approaches, and also see how Bloch sphere, the spins on Bloch sphere, they evolve using Schrodinger and Heisenberg picture. So I hope there was something for everyone, even if you knew Schrodinger and Heisenberg picture earlier. And then interaction picture probably was new for at least a few of you, density matrix. And then we also did the path integral approach. So we kind of tried to build quantum mechanics from all these different approaches, which are equivalent. In the next 7 lectures, you are going to look at another equivalent approach, which is the canonical quantization approach to build quantum theory. And I would say the main purpose was to have everyone at the same level, because some of you already knew more, maybe knew more than what we have done, but it was necessary to have everyone at the same level so that you are ready for the future courses. And I think most of these topics which we have done, you would be seeing. I'm not sure about the Schrodinger-Heisenberg approach, but including interaction picture, density matrix, and path integral are for sure to come up in your advanced courses, okay?